Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hey, folks. This is TJ Raphael, digital editor for The Takeaway. After 5 years, today's my last day with the show, but you'll still be able to get our daily podcast in your feed Monday to Friday. It's been great interacting with you guys over the years. Thanks so much. And now, without further ado, here's the Takeaway podcast for Thursday, March 15th, 2018.
I am looking at a lot of smoke. Do I need to get out of here?
I don't know, sir. If you do, the sheriff's department will advise you.
Okay, well, I just called 911 and they directed me to you.
Sir, I understand. We have no idea. We have fires all over the county. Do what you need to do. Bye.
We just opened it up and it was like a roaring ocean of fire. The whole hill was just roaring.
911, what is your emergency?
We're wondering if we needed to evacuate.
If you see fire by your house, then you should probably call 911 and evacuate.
Should we be driving towards East Road or should we go towards Willis?
I don't really know, sir. You would have to look at where the fire is and not go that way.
What's on fire?
A transformer blew, PG&E transformer, and it lit up a whole window.
And there was a fire. What's on fire?
It was on fire all around me. I immediately thought we were going to die and that was it. We had waited too long.
Copy, unit this is 2320 Atlas Peak Road for parents trapped in a garage.
On October 8th of last year, massive wildfires broke out across Northern California. 44 people died, 21,000 structures were damaged or destroyed, and the fires burned an area the size of Maryland and Delaware combined. Even today, it's unknown what sparked the fires in the first place. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And the scale of those fires in Northern California was huge. But even while the fires still burned, it was clear that emergency services were simply overwhelmed. Suki Lewis is a reporter for KQED News in San Francisco, and she and Lisa Pickoff-White, who's a data reporter for KQED, immediately started investigating what went wrong with California's response to the fires, and they did it in partnership with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting.
So on the first day of the fire, Suki started actually going out in the field to report while another coworker and I, Risa Lago, started filing public record requests for 911 calls and also starting to listen to dispatch, that kind of radio chatter between first responders. And the reason we were doing that is we were hearing already from community members that there were these big delays in evacuation orders going out. We were also really curious about what had caused the fires. I mean, we knew that there was this big warning actually from the National Weather Service that the conditions were very ripe for a fire. But we had heard from people that there were all of these electrical incidents also going on. And one of our first big revelations from those tapes as they started coming in and the three of us started going through them, also with a team of reporters, was that actually by 4 p.m., there already were these kind of down power lines, sparking power lines, transformer explosions being reported, you know, throughout a pretty wide area in two different counties. And by 7 p.m., those start coming in almost every few minutes. And the problem with electrical incidents, really, is that they build on each other, right? So once, you know, some power lines go down, then that power has to go somewhere. So it goes out to other electrical lines, overpowers them, and that can eventually cause these transformer explosions. And it kind of becomes this vicious circle where the more of the grid goes down, the more dangerous it can become. And so we started hearing a lot of calls like this one.
PG&E emergency dispatch.
Hi, I need, this is Redcom, I need you expedited for a wires down that started a structure fire.
Is there anyone trapped in that location?
Nope, fire's on scene. I have to go. Bye-bye.
There were actually 172 different fires happening kind of all at the same time. Some of them may have been electrical and some of them, you know, like I said, there are these really high winds that could be spreading as sparks are flying. And what could happen in the situation, and actually happens sometimes on the East Coast or the southern parts of the United States for hurricanes, for instance, is that you preemptively shut down the power grid when you know that there's going to be these high winds. But we don't do that in Northern California. And what really interested me about that is that we do that in Southern California. In fact, they had done that more than 16 times before these fires began this summer in Southern California to stop these fires from starting, you know, before.
Well, Suki, you can hear the urgency in that caller that Lisa just played concerning the electrical fires. And I imagine that with dispatch all over the area on October 8th and 9th, that was repeated a lot.
Just to kind of give you a sense of how many people were calling in, you know, we have personally listened to thousands of calls from the night of these fires, and they were just people were calling into 911 to report smoke, to report fires, to report these electrical problems. And this created its own kind of vicious cycle because people were calling in sometimes, you know, just to report smoke, and that's then clogging the line for people who actually really need help and are trapped behind a fire line and need to get information, you know, to first responders. And what we also found out is that these kind of electrical problems that Lisa was talking about drained resources early. So they were sending out like a fire engine to this little fire, a fire engine to this little fire. And so then when these massive fires, the Atlas Peak fire or the Tubbs fire, which was, you know, just completely devastating and burned into the city of Santa Rosa, when those first started taking off, resources were already depleted. And so there wasn't people to send when these massive blazes took off. And so these communication failures also start to kind of build one on top of the other. And people who are trying to call 911 get a busy signal. They don't know what to do. And so they keep calling. And 911 operators are kind of stuck in this situation where they can't get the information they need. So they don't know what to tell people.
Holy Mother of God, can I help you?
I want to help you.
We need help bad.
You want me to head that way?
Yes.
Over to Calistoga?
I have no idea. We have like 9 fires out of control. We're out of control. Mandatory evacuation.
And this, I want to go to a fire, but whatever you want.
Starting here, I'm sure we'll send you.
Okay, bye.
So, Lisa, people calling in electrical fires all around the area, communication between the fire department and emergency responders chasing electrical fires, also trying to respond to the massive big fires, these big issues out there. Then there's also the issue of evacuation, getting people out of neighborhoods, homes that might be threatened. What did you find?
Yeah, so what we found was that there were delays between when first responders on the ground were seeing these fires and asking for evacuation orders and those evacuation orders really reaching people. And there's actually a couple of problems to unpack here. So one of the first problems is, you know, what we saw several times, there was an hour delay, like I said, between a firefighter seeing that fire and actually these evacuation orders going out. And one reason that that was happening is because, like Suki said, there was this kind of big clogging of the machinery. Because in this case, on that night, what was happening is that actually firefighters were kind of calling their chief. Then their chief was calling 911 operators because the dispatch is actually the same place. So those calls all are going to the same place, whether you're trapped by the fire or you're a fire chief trying to order an evacuation. It's all going to the same dispatch center. So in one case, we actually even heard a fire chief put on hold for a period of time who's trying to say, hey, we have to send out mandatory evacuations right now. People's lives are in danger. And what we also saw is that counties have to decide how to send out these emergency alerts, right? So they have a couple of options. They can send out what's called wireless emergency alerts. And those are those amber alerts that set off your cell phone and everyone is really familiar with. And in Sonoma County, they actually had the capability to do that and chose not to because they were afraid of mass panic. What a lot of counties ended up doing instead is sending out these kind of texts and emails for opt-in systems that you have to kind of know about beforehand. And these fires were really building in the middle of the night. And so you have, texts going out to people at like 2 a.m. who are maybe not receiving them. And at this point, actually, the fires had also burnt down along with homes. The fires had burnt down cell phone towers and cables. So some people's landlines weren't even operable.
Well, you and your colleagues in this report, as you said, listened to thousands of 911 calls and other emergency calls from those fires. And for all of the shortcomings and all of the confusion, Suki, I'm sure that you also found some examples of heroism or first responders who saved lives.
Absolutely. And like the kind of critique and the look back at a lot of this is to look at systems and where they failed and how they could be improved. And I think what we found time and time again is that individuals acted completely heroically, went above and beyond to save their neighbors. You know, first responders did absolutely put their lives at risk to save other people. And one of those people that we talked to was California Highway Patrol helicopter pilot Pete Gavitt, who flew to this place called Atlas Peak. That's this peak in the hills above the city of Napa with this one road in and one road out where a lot of people got trapped when the Atlas Peak fire broke out.
We were just, both of us just sick because we would hear, you know, family of four trapped here or people trying to survive. And there, we heard people climbing into their water tanks to survive, and we couldn't help them. So it was a sick feeling.
That pilot and his co-pilot actually ended up rescuing 26 people off of Atlas Peak, flying them off when the road out, the one road out, was blocked by trees and power lines. And so I think he was just one of many heroes who kind of showed up to save people that night.
So, Lisa, what are state officials saying here in response? It's an overwhelming disaster, and that's understandable. Do they see a systemic problem here, lessons learned for next time, and any plan on how to do things differently?
Yeah, so actually we are seeing some changes both on the federal, national, and even local level. One of the big changes actually has been a national one with the FCC to those kinds of wireless emergency alerts. So one reason that, you know, local officials here were afraid to use them was because they couldn't target really specific areas and because there were some limitations to them. And actually, the FCC this winter changed some of that so that now those messages can go to more specific geographic areas. And also, they can be longer alerts. They used to just be 90 characters. And also, soon they'll be available in Spanish language, which especially actually for an area like Northern California, which has a substantial amount of Spanish-speaking residents, is very important. And then also locally, we've seen that, for instance, 911 operators are getting new scripts so that they know what to tell people who are calling when they're trapped by fire.
Yeah, I think one of the other big lessons that we're seeing coming out of this is that sometimes no one is coming to save you. And you need to know what your risk is, know what your wildfire risk is, know what your escape routes are, have your go bag ready, and kind of the personal responsibility angle that comes into this. And so I think the, you know, Office of Emergency Services here, the director, Mark Ghilarducci, was really saying as we kind of enter this new normal that, you know, these massive events are becoming more likely and more intense with climate change, that all Californians and really everyone across the country kind of needs to understand that things have changed.
Suki Lewis and Lisa Pickoff White reported this story along with Marisa Lagos for KQED in San Francisco. Suki, Lisa, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
KQED reported this investigation in partnership with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. You can find links to their investigation on our website at thetakeaway.org.
Kyle Preston from Santa Rosa, California. I did not receive any emergency information from my government official. I received info by word of mouth and turned to a local radio station for information. I decided to voluntarily evacuate at about 3 a.m. October 9th. After looking outside and seeing the sky glowing orange to the north and east of my home.
Harrowing accounts of the fires in Northern California. You can share your stories from the California wildfires with us on the Takeaways Facebook page. Deadly nerve agents and the attempted murder of a former Russian spy have terrified the residents of Salisbury, England, over the last week. Now the UK government has responded. Prime Minister Theresa May announced 23 Russian diplomats are to be expelled from Britain and that high-level contacts with Russia are to be cut off. In the House of Commons on Wednesday, Theresa May wanted to show that she was laying blame on Vladimir Putin's doorstep.
Mr. Speaker, it was right to offer Russia the opportunity to provide an explanation. But their response has demonstrated complete disdain for the gravity of these events. They have provided no credible explanation that could suggest they lost control of their nerve agent. No explanation as to how this agent came to be used in the United Kingdom. No explanation as to why Russia has an undeclared chemical weapons program in contravention of international law.
Russia has denied any role in the attempted poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter. Still, nearly two dozen Russian diplomats are going home, but not everyone thinks this is quite the crackdown that the prime minister promised. Ryan Chilcote is a journalist and Russia expert in the UK who spent years in both London and Moscow.
So 23 diplomats is the equivalent of 40% of the sort of key embassy staff. So it definitely hampers their ability to do diplomatic work or to do, as the UK maintains, intelligence work without revealing that. At the same time, as you and I both know, a lot of intelligence work nowadays is done on the internet and through cyber operations. So it's not entirely clear to me that it makes a huge difference, but certainly the government is saying that this will be helpful in dismantling Russia's espionage network in the UK.
Now, you say that Theresa May had many, many more options that she could have executed here to get tough on Russia, and that there were members of parliament who were leaning on her to do that. What more could she have done? What's in the toolkit for a prime minister who wants to really get tough on Vladimir Putin and his people?
Well, look, at one point, just to give you an example of how serious this could have gotten, there were some suggesting that she could invoke Article 5 of the NATO, collective security agreement. In other words, she could say that an attack against Britain had taken place by, an enemy of Britain, and she could call on Britain's NATO allies to respond to the attack. In other words, effectively attack Russia, or at least acknowledge that Russia had attacked the United Kingdom. She didn't do that. That's pretty extreme. London is a financial center. Arguably, it shares the post with New York City, the world's financial center. A lot of Russian billionaires are here. A lot of Russian companies traditionally have raised money here. Britain has always been very pragmatic about accepting money from around the world because it helps business here in the UK. It helps all the banks here in Britain. She could have cracked down on that. She didn't really. 23 diplomats, it's going to make their life a little bit more difficult. They'll have to, go home. Russia will expel some British diplomats. But in the big scheme of things, it's a pretty small fry. She really did the bare minimum in a way.
It seems like Theresa May also could have made life difficult for some of those Russian billionaires, some of those oligarchs who enjoy townhouses in Chelsea and other places around London, seized some of their assets, made it hard for them to get to their homes.
Absolutely. And, if you're and there are practical reasons other than the fact that, for many people, having, a beautiful home in London is an insurance policy in a way against badness back at home, because you can always just go to London and live there if things go sour back at home for you. It's also just a very practical place for the Russians to do business with the rest of the world. Russia's, a little bit out of the way for many people. You need a travel visa to get there. So she could have. And, there are literally dozens of Russian billionaires, also known as oligarchs, who have, palatial homes here. And she could have really cracked down on them. She could make it much more difficult for them to do business here. And I know for a fact, having spoken with many of them, that they were very concerned about that. But that hasn't happened, at least yet.
Well, Ryan, then the question is why? Why, after such a high-profile, brutal, attempted murder on the streets of England, would the prime minister essentially take a soft approach?
There's a couple parts to that. First off, it would not be without consequence for Britain itself, right? The Russians bring a lot of investment, just like the Chinese, just like the Arabs. And so they would be depriving them of that investment. All of a sudden, London wouldn't look like the safe place for money from around the world that it has been. I mean, that would be really going counter to what London has been for the last, 25 years. And the second thing is, maybe there are some people that think that, actually, just because they have money and they're from Russia doesn't mean we should punish them, even if we believe, as clearly the British government does, that the Kremlin was behind this attack. That isn't necessarily the most effective way to deal with this. In other words, as the prime minister herself said, you know, maybe they shouldn't all Russians or people, as she said, of Russian extraction shouldn't be tarred with the same brush.
So talk a little bit more about what you think the lesson learned is here for Vladimir Putin and the Russians, assuming that they are behind this attack, as the Brits think they are. What's the message for Vladimir Putin right now?
Well, the message, you know, that's obviously being sent to Vladimir Putin from the UK and at least rhetorically from the rest of the West is that you won't get away with this, but the action isn't quite commensurate with the threat. So, you know, I think he will say, all right, we get that. But if you look here, for example, even in the UK, as the prime minister announced the expulsion of these 23 Russian diplomats, you then heard the leader of the opposition in this country effectively questioning why she was doing that without giving Russia more time. Then his spokesman questioning the veracity of the evidence, you know, sort of saying, well, you know, our chemical weapons investigators, our intelligence services don't always get it right when it comes to chemical weapons. Take a look at what happened with Iraq. And, you know, we thought there was WMD there. Well, this kind of division that has been created by this, you know, this incident in Salisbury, this poisoning, you know, the fact that it's already divisive within British politics, as we saw with the story of Russian meddling in the United States, well, that's not contrary to Vladimir Putin's interests in the West. Let's just put it that way.
Ryan Chilcote, journalist and Russia expert in the UK. Ryan, great to have you. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
In the small town of Dera in southern Syria, 7 years ago today, people took to the streets. The winds of the Arab Spring were blowing across the Middle East, and people in Dera wanted their rights. There was hope and even some joy in those days as people were anticipating change. We know now what the Syrian conflict has become, a civil war that's killed an estimated 500,000 people and displaced 11 million. But it didn't start that way.
It wasn't really a war. It started out as the demonstrations just to improve the standard of living. Nobody wanted a war. They were just demonstrating in the street to hopefully improve things in Syria. They turned it into a war.
Muna is from Damascus. She left with her family after living through a year of the fighting. They arrived in the United States last January and asked that we not use their last name to protect their family members who are still in Syria. When Muna says they turned it into a war, she's referring to the regime of President Bashar al-Assad, an ophthalmologist whose father ruled Syria for nearly three decades until 2000.
The whole war started when children wrote on the wall, "Your turn, doctor." The Secret Service arrested them and he beat them up, and that's how the whole thing started.
That's Muna's husband, Hussein, talking about what many Syrians consider the start of the civil war. A group of teenagers in the city of Dera wrote pro-revolution graffiti on some concrete walls. But on the seventh anniversary of those protests in Syria, we wanted to tell the story of those early days before demonstration turned to bloodshed. It's a time that Rula Amin remembers well. Today, Amin is a senior spokesperson at the UN Refugee Agency for the Middle East and North Africa. In 2011, she was working as a journalist in Beirut, and she traveled to Damascus and to Dera right as the first protests got started.
It was a very unfamiliar scene in Syria because you had these thousands of people on the streets, very defiant, very empowered, calling for freedoms, calling for more democracy, calling for an end to corruption, calling for having a more say in their lives. And it was so unfamiliar to see these people on the streets in Syria.
Was there any response from the government at the time, even if it was lip service, to say, yes, we can talk about some of these grievances, just go back to your homes and we'll have a conversation? Did anything like that go on at first?
Well, you know, it's with Syria, there's always two narratives. If you talk to the opposition, they will say the government just crushed their initial protest, and that's what led to the armed conflict. And if you talk to people who are more supportive of the government, they would say the government was engaging and that they promised some changes, but it was not enough because regional powers were meddling with Syria and there were other drivers and people were being paid to do this. But I have to say, at that first week, at those first 2 weeks, people still had hopes that the Syrian president would stand actually by them, that he would actually meet their demands. And that's why most of the slogans we were hearing then were not directed against him as much as the people around him, the security elite. They had hopes that with these protests, they will be able to bring change to Syria.
And people in the streets, it seems to me, Rula, might have looked, as you said, to Tunisia. They might have looked to Cairo. They might have looked to other places around the Arab world and thought that their president, Bashar al-Assad, might want to respond because there was tension all over the region.
Yes, people had very high hopes then. And that's why it's very sad when you talk to people now. And you can see the sad turn in how the hopes were dashed, in how the expectations now have turned into just a daily struggle to make ends meet, to put food on the table for their children, to give to their children an education. On average, less than 50% of Syrian refugee children are at school now. So you can see where the shift is in people's expectations and hopes from 7 years before to now.
Well, then, Rula, describe the moment when you realized or you remember that things were shifting, that the mood was changing, and that these protests, peaceful in the street with a lot of hope, were taking a dark turn.
You know, I don't know if we can say there's a moment. It happened over many years. But you can see it when, in the beginning of these protests, you could see people by the thousands, men and women on the streets demanding for more freedoms and democracy. And then you could see it shifting where more and more it was armed confrontation between armed groups and the government forces, and the real people were withdrawing back to their homes. But then you started seeing more foreign fighters coming in on both sides to support the government and to support the opposition. Slowly, slowly you start seeing even with the refugees outside the country, you know, many of them, when they left their homes, they thought they'll be back soon. And 1 year after another, they started coming to this conviction that this is endless and it's not about anymore about the goals they went out to the streets for, that it's now, this is a fight for different regional and international agendas that has nothing to do with their own goals, their own aspirations, or what they need as Syrians.
And what happened, Rula, to make largely a secular protest against corruption, against police brutality and the rest, turn into a sectarian war of the kind that we've seen in so many other places around the Middle East?
Well, I don't know if I can call it a secular protest in the beginning. I mean, in the beginning, it didn't have the sectarian tone. Syria is a regional power, and what happens in Syria affects the whole region. There are many countries on whether those who are with the government or the opposition have interest in what's happening in Syria and what kind of regime prevails there. And I think both sides used the most effective propaganda and rallying and mobilizing tools they have. And since people are religious in general, and since people are conservative in general in many parts of Syria, playing on the sectarian tone, playing on people's sectarian polarization was easy to mobilize people. And I think maybe it didn't start as a sectarian protest, but then with both sides using every tool they have to mobilize people around their cause and their argument, sectarianism and religion was a major tool and it was effective.
What do Syrians make of the outside forces that are helping to perpetuate this war?
They feel that they have no say anymore in whether this conflict goes on or doesn't go on, becomes an armed conflict, not an armed conflict. There are so many different fault lines in Syria now, and there are so many different foreign players and elements on the ground in Syria, whether they're Russians or Turks. They feel they lost control. That's what they tell us. They follow what's happening now with a sense of hopelessness and despair that, I mean, as I would tell you what UNHCR's High Commissioner said, and I think that actually captures it. And he said, you know, maybe there are no clear winners in this war, but the losers, you can see them, and they are the Syrian people.
And with so much destruction, so many Syrians having lost their lives and so many having lost their homes and fled to other parts of the world, Rula, does the issue of whether Bashar al-Assad remains president, does that even matter to most people anymore? There was so much discussion about it in the early days of this conflict, and now it seems very far beside the point.
To be honest, when I was in Syria covering this as a journalist the first few months, and then I was covering it from Beirut, and then I went back as a journalist, in the beginning, people were adamant on this goal. They wanted a change in the regime after so many months. It was clear, and they wanted a revolution. Now, when you talk to people, especially when you talk to the refugees, all they want is an end to the conflict as soon as possible. They feel that the fighting, the ongoing fighting, is futile. It's not really bringing them closer to anything. So they feel they're just paying. More people are dying. There's more destruction. Even the possibility of them returning to Syria and in safety and in dignity and being able to reestablish their lives, even that hope is diminishing. So to them, they want this to stop today before tomorrow.
Rula Amin, former journalist and senior spokesperson at the UN Refugee Agency for the Middle East and North Africa. Rula, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Hamid Hayat was born in California and raised in the town of Lodi. It's a community with a large Pakistani population. In 2003, Hayat traveled to Pakistan, where his parents are from, and that trip caught the attention of American counterterrorism authorities. Hayat wound up getting tried and convicted of aiding jihadists. Well, Hayat's case is complicated. It involves post-9/11 terror charges, questions about the credibility of an informant, and access to classified evidence against him. To this day, Hayat, from prison, says he's innocent. But the piece that our friends at the Marshall Project are looking at in this week's Case in Point hinges on video testimony in the courtroom, and in Hamid's case, video alibi testimony from foreign nationals on foreign soil. Abby Van Sickle is staff writer at the Marshall Project and author of this week's Case in Point, and she explains Hamid Hayat's case.
Hamid Hayat is, he's from Lodi, California. He's an American citizen. And back in 2005, the FBI accused him of material support to terrorism for going to a jihadi training camp in Pakistan. A jury convicted him. A judge sentenced him to 24 years in federal prison. And that's where he is right now.
Why did Hayat say he was in Pakistan? Because he says the government has it all wrong.
So Hamid Hayat, his family has deep roots in Pakistan, and for most of his childhood, he sort of lived in both worlds. He's gone back and forth between a rural village in Pakistan and California, and he says that in 2003, he went back to Pakistan in order to find a bride, to find a local woman to marry, and that he did do that, that he married in his home village and remained there for 2 years until May 2005, when he headed back to California with his family.
Hayat has an appeal before a federal judge now, and he says, his lawyers say, that there were all kinds of problems, all kinds of shortcomings that led up to his conviction. Talk about some of those. And most importantly, let's start with access to classified evidence, because we've heard this theme time and time again in terrorism cases, people being tried based on evidence that's secret.
Yes. So in his case, at the trial, his trial lawyer, it was her first criminal case, she did not seek a security clearance. So that meant that the government's, any evidence they had that was classified, she was not able to see it or to participate in hearings about it. And so the prosecutors and the judge, you know, they could look at that evidence and talk about it, but she couldn't participate. And so in his appeal, that's a really big point that Hamid is making, is that he was never able to fully participate to understand and see the evidence that the government was using against him.
So Abby, here's where it gets interesting and a little bit problematic. A lot of the corroboration for his side of the story, essentially an alibi, it's not here in the United States where he's being held. It's overseas. It's in Pakistan, right?
That's right. So it's not in dispute that Hamid went to Pakistan. Hamid says he did. The government says he did. It's a question of what he did when he was there. And Hamid says that he was in this little rural village called Babudi, and that people in the village would know if he had left for several months to go to any kind of terrorist training camp. So he says he has an alibi and all these people willing to explain where he was and what he was doing while he was there.
So why can't they just explain it?
So they did actually end up explaining it during this really fascinating hearing a few weeks ago. So the witnesses are, you know, all in this rural village. They couldn't get visas to come to the United States. His defense lawyers had proposed that the defense and the prosecutors all travel to Pakistan and interview them, take their testimony, but the prosecutors objected to that. And so the judge allowed video conference testimony to, you know, essentially setting up a screen in the courtroom, keeping the court open from 5:30 to 10 o'clock at night so that these witnesses could testify in the daytime in Pakistan. And so we all watched, you know, you could see their faces and hear their voices as they talked about what Hamid was doing in their home village for those 2 years.
What did these people in rural Pakistan say during their testimony about Hayat's time there?
So they told pretty consistent stories, essentially that Hamid stayed in the village, that he left very rarely and only for a couple of days at a time. He was there with his mother, and his mother has some health issues, and he would go with her to a nearby city for her health appointments to see a doctor. And once he went to a friend's wedding with some other friends for a few days, but that other than that he never left for any significant amount of time. All of them were very clear that they didn't think he was the sort of person who would be capable of traveling alone. A couple of years before, he had suffered from meningitis, and they testified that, you know, he was not very strong and would be very timid about traveling on any kind of public transport or going anywhere by himself. They said that he mainly stayed in the village, that he played cricket, that he hung out with his friend at the local tailoring shop, and that he led a very sort of simple, quiet life.
So it's a remarkable proceeding, but it's a little bit complicated because when people testify in court, I mean, video testimony certainly isn't unheard of, but these are people on foreign soil. Can they be made, for instance, to swear an oath to tell the truth? Does that stick if you're testifying from a village in rural Pakistan?
That's one of the things that everyone had discussed in court is, what do you do about an oath? In the United States, there are a couple of things that we do in order to try to ensure that witnesses are telling the truth. One is that the proceedings are held in a courtroom or an official building with the idea that if you're in a formal setting, you will realize, you know, the importance of telling the truth. And the other is to swear an oath, to swear that you're going to tell the truth. And so what do you do if you're testifying in a country where, you know, if these witnesses lied in Pakistan, if they swore an oath for an American court and they committed perjury, it's highly unlikely they would be brought to the U.S. to be, you know, to face perjury charges. And so that's a question that the judge had asked the lawyers and that I'm imagining they're going to be debating when they file their briefings, you know, in the next couple months.
Has this kind of thing happened before with overseas testimony? Is there any precedent?
There's definitely been overseas testimony of witnesses for the prosecution. In those sorts of cases, as the prosecutor talked about in Hamid's case, the prosecutors have a lot of support, typically in finding courts where they can take the testimony and support from local prosecutors and local judges. This is a much more rare situation. I can't say that it's never happened before, but I've been looking to try to find, you know, other cases where this sort of thing has happened, and I haven't been able to find other cases. The defense lawyer in this case called it unprecedented.
So his appeal is in front of the judge now. What's next for Hamid Hayat?
So his lawyers have been trying to get his conviction overturned. The defense lawyers and the prosecutors now have a couple of months to brief what happened in the evidentiary hearing, and then the judge is going to make a determination after looking at the evidence.
Abby Van Sickle, staff writer for the Marshall Project and author of this week's Case in Point. Abby, great to have you.
Thank you so much.
How do you do? I'm Todd Zwillick, and it's great to have you with us on The Takeaway. You know, drag has a long storied history, and drag queens right now are enjoying what's probably their most visible moment of popularity. Today you have drag queens on reality TV. RuPaul has a hit with RuPaul's Drag Race. Of course, Dr. Frankenfurter is the queen of queens. That's obvious. But what about drag kings? They have a lot of history too, but you just don't see that much of them in pop culture. Well, here in New York, there's only one all-drag king show in Brooklyn. It's called Beef, and it's run by Leave Alone, the drag king also known as the Reverend Mr. Leave Alone Velour. So why haven't drag kings made the big time? Well, I sat down with Lee to find out more, along with Jezebel pop culture reporter Hazel Sills, who's just written a piece all about the world of drag kings. And I asked Lee Vallone first to explain just what a drag king really is.
To me, drag is just a performance of gender with an intention of sharing a story. So all a drag king is a person performing a gender with the intention of sharing a story that is presenting masculine. And that can look a lot of different ways for a lot of different people. Masculinity is just as broad a spectrum as femininity, but because in our culture, masculinity is seen as neutral, we don't think of it that way. But it doesn't mean it's not true.
So give me some examples. I mean, I can certainly envision them. I've seen some of your performances, but when it gets on stage up to you, I've seen you do Johnny Cash for one, but you do other characters too.
Yeah. So my Johnny Cash character is a very classic example of a drag king act in the beginning. But as the act progresses, it's a boy named Sue. And the whole narrative is about this character that meets his father and realizes that it's okay to be named Sue. It, for me, relates to my identity as a trans person, how I was born this way, but it's okay that I identify that way, that a way that I do now. And the whole narrative, it starts off with a drag king coming out in Johnny Cash cowboy look, but then it ends up with me in this horrifying red negligee thing that I can't believe I own this garment. That's a very classic drag king act, but some of my other work, I do a lot of Led Zeppelin. I do a Gandalf the Grey turning into Gandalf the White to Stairway to Heaven.
Oh, it's, really?
Yeah, it's really good. I'm biased, but it's really good, my dude.
I have to come out and see your show now, I guess. I was about to ask if I can see a video, but now I have to come see
it. You should just come see it.
Yeah.
It runs the gamut. Some people are very glamorous. Some people are very punk. Some people like to relive their tween years where they were this sad, sad emo punk kid, and now they get to do this on stage. I mean, kings, we're doing everything, and it's all very exciting.
Hazel, you've spent a lot of time researching this world and the history of this art form. How old is this art form and how has it come up?
Fluid gender drag has sort of existed for obviously decades, centuries, but the term drag king sort of came into being in the 90s. There was sort of this drag king boom in the 90s that was sort of rising at the same time as queer theory. And you had theorists like Jack Halberstam and, you know, Judith Butler, who were writing all of these books and academic scholarship sort of complicating these ideas of gender. And drag kinging sort of evolved out of that scene.
Is there an older history here, too? I mean, is there a history in places like, I don't know, New York, L.A., other cities of drag king shows? Maybe they weren't called that at the time. These shows of masculinity that go way back?
Yeah, I mean, certainly in the late 20th century, there was this idea of the male impersonator. That was certainly more based in music and music impersonation and gender impersonation. But then drag king performances differ significantly from male impersonation because it is much more of a performance. It is much more of this complication of gender on stage and sort of figuring out these new ideas of what masculinity looks like.
Lee, I went to see Cher a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. How was she?
I mean,
was she wonderful?
She was great. Now, I bring up Cher because Cher is a legend among drag queens. There are lots and lots of Cher performers out there. Are there famous men popular for drag kings? Is there a Cher analog?
Elvis.
Yeah?
A lot of people do Elvis throughout the drag king world, but most drag kings, like, in one way or another, will embody Mick Jagger in some way. So I would say Elvis, I would say Mick Jagger, and for the more alternative and country-based drag kings, Johnny Cash. Johnny Cash is the best Johnny Cash, but Johnny Cash, everyone does Johnny Cash.
Hazel, drag queens have dominated this really visible part of drag pop culture. Why has it taken so long, or why has it been simply more difficult for kings to break through? It's out there. You don't hear a lot about it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's certainly a few reasons. One of them being, as Lee mentioned before, there is this misconception that masculinity cannot be as involved and intensive of a performance as femininity. Femininity and performances of femininity, the kind that drag queens do, we know what that looks like. It's the big wigs, it's the big, you know, the tall shoes, it's the glitter eyeliner, it's everything. It's this big performance. But it's a lot harder for mainstream audiences to visualize what performances of masculinity look like. And it was so fun to see such a wide range of performances of masculinity at Beef. You know, there were the sexy kind of rock star performances, but there were also kings who were, you know, there was that great number from a drag king named Dorian Gay who did this kind of like dopey cowboy Garth Brooks, you know, where number where he was kind of like square dancing across the stage. And so drag kings have sort of struggled because it's been harder for them to prove to audiences that what they're doing can be as exciting as what drag queens are doing. And then another reason drag kings have sort of struggled is because there was sort of that drag king boom in the 1990s. Those performances, those drag nights were rising out of lesbian nightlife, lesbian clubs and culture. And unfortunately, due to things like gentrification, those bars have largely disappeared across the country, whereas nightlife where drag queens perform, those clubs have sort of thrived. And so it's hard for kings to even find places to perform.
And if I may, for me, a lot of it has to do with the fact that culturally women are seen as objects to be studied, viewed, and consumed. Masculinity, for the good, bad, or ugly, is not seen that way. So a drag queen can walk into a bar and immediately start up a party or start a conversation or do a number and everyone has their attention. A drag king walks into a bar most of the time, unless he looks absolutely fabulous, no one's even going to notice, because we're not taught that masculinity can be glamorous, exciting, or interesting, because culturally masculinity is not consumed in the same way that femininity is.
Well, Lee, you know, your show just seems like it's an awful lot of fun.
It is.
There's a lot of hooting and hollering. There's a lot of applause and even a couple of dollar bills getting passed up your way, I noticed. Mm-hmm. But what are you trying to say? What's the message in your performance?
Sure. The thing I'm trying to say with Beef Show generally is that kings are here and we're exciting and we want you to see us. And that gender is bigger than just a spectrum or a grid, and that political beliefs and emotions belong on a stage. So my drag mother is the one and only Sasha Velour of season 9 RuPaul Drag Race. And she always says that it is okay to cry at the drag show. And it is okay to cry at the drag show. I regularly cry on that stage because my stories that I have that I want to share with everyone are not always nice. And for me, drag is extremely political. That's the kind of work I want to show on stage.
Lee, a lot of listeners aren't going to get a chance to get to Brooklyn to see Beef Show. That's unfortunate. They might not have drag kings in their town. In fact, we've learned that they probably don't. Then maybe they should, but they probably don't. So what's a good way for people to check it out?
The best way to find out what drag is doing right now and what drag kings are doing is just to go on Instagram and follow the hashtag dragkingdrag. You can follow the hashtag beefshow. You can follow the hashtag dragkings of Instagram. And the thing that you have to know about all drag performers is we really enjoy pictures of ourselves. So everything that's happening probably is documented and is probably on Instagram. That's the most exciting thing for me. Is I get up every morning and I scroll through and I see what someone in LA did at a show last night, or I see what happened at Boy Box in London last night. We're really, really lucky to have access to a platform where we can put the visual representation of what we're doing for free. And that's the easiest way to find out what kings are doing.
Now, this is radio, and I have to say, this is probably the first time I've ever really regretted being on the radio, Lee, because Hazel mentioned the big tall shoes of drag queens, and you have worn some shoes into the studio today that are worthy of any visual medium, and we don't get to see them, unfortunately.
Oh, it's such a shame. They're great shoes.
They're tall and black and white and amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, I was low-key nervous about this interview, and day drag is real, and I just thought, if I'm going to go talk about being a king, I need to feel like a king. So I'm in my 7-inch platform black and white heels. I've got my white fur coat, and I'm wearing my usual black uniform, but, you know, I've It's important to feel the king that you are inside.
Well, my daddy left home when I was 3, and he didn't leave much to Ma and me. Just this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze. Now, I don't blame him because he run and hid, but the meanest thing that he ever did was before he left, he went and named me Sue.
That was Leave Alone, or the Reverend Mr. Leave Alone Velour, who runs the drag king show Beef in Brooklyn, and Hazel Sills, Pop Culture for Jezebel. You can see a photo of Lee's most fabulous shoes on our website at thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, you'll also find a link to Hazel's reporting for Jezebel on the drag kings. We end today, though, on a bittersweet note. Our digital editor, TJ Raphael, is leaving us today. TJ is moving on to other adventures at Slate after 5 years at The Takeaway. TJ, we will miss you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The moon and stars, I'd search the honky-tonks and bars and kill that man and give me that awful name. Well, it was Gatlinburg in mid-July, and I just hit town and my throat was dry. I thought I'd stop and have myself a groove. At an old saloon on a street of mud, there at a table, peeling stud, sat the dirty mangy dog that named me Sue.